May it please honorable court. Pete Christiansen on behalf of the appellate Frederick Mendoza, who was sentenced to death in November of 2008 by a jury here in Clark County. And I, if it would be acceptable to the court, would start with the Batson issue that is raised and start from the standpoint of trial counsel in this case. While there are plenty of criticisms laid out in the briefing, no question understood the fact that Mr. Mendoza, and it's been conceded by the prosecution, the state of Nevada, is a protected class, and the defense lawyers knew it. Because they filed a motion dealing with the underrepresentation, the facial, prima facie underrepresentation of that protected class. That motion, for absolutely no strategic reason, and devoid in the record, is there any reasoning behind it, simply gets withdrawn. So rather than litigate the issue of the underrepresentation of Hispanics, the motion is, for no reason, withdrawn without explanation, and there is none either in the answering brief or on the record is before you. From that factual pretext, move forward then to the jury selection, where 121 jurors answer the call, 100 submit jury questionnaires, and our questionnaires used in this case, which from my perspective is helpful because it puts a record before this court of what each and every juror said or didn't say. From the 100 jurors, there is six that are Hispanic or of the protected class to which the defendant and the appellate in this case belong. So in depending if you use the census statistics or the Nevada demographer statistics, that is a facially or prima facie underrepresentation of somewhere between 17% and 19% of the Hispanic population here in Clark County, which depending on which of those censuses you rely upon is somewhere between 23% and 25%. From there, you must move forward and recognize that the state uses 50% or one half of its 8 peremptory challenges to strike the 4 minority Hispanic jurors that survived the four cause veneer. The four cause process takes 2 of the 6 Hispanics that have answered the questionnaires and narrows it down to 4. The state strikes a juror, I think is number 17, CS, a second juror, another Hispanic person, and for no reason are these defense lawyers not objecting and making a Batson challenge. They recognize the underrepresentation. They filed the motion. They withdrew it for no reason. They recognize or clearly must recognize Hispanics are being stricken. The second time it happens makes it a pattern. Yet it takes a third time for the striking of the juror identified as 17LA for the defense lawyers to make a Batson objection. The Batson objection is made. The prosecution lays out, in fact, interestingly, doesn't say that there is no pattern, but says, in fact, let me give you my race-neutral reason, and it deals with youth and life experience and the like. However, under the pretextual analysis of whether those questions or those persons in the protected class are being treated differently than others, if you simply compare, and it's done in the brief, it's done thoroughly in the opening brief, a comparative analysis of the Caucasian jurors that are allowed to sit on this panel who have far more problematic issues than the Hispanic jurors. Remember that the state has now taken, by the time a Batson objection is raised, they've taken from a panel of 100, 98 of 100 people away. There's only 2 left that are Hispanic. And so the analysis from my perspective, and I'm not underappreciative of the Hawkins decision this court rendered earlier this year, in August of this year, that deals with the difficulty you all have. It is, Your Honor. I apologize, Your Honor. The panel issues a decision on August 4th of 2011 that addresses, from my perspective, the difficulty an appellate court faces in determining whether something was pretextual or not pretextual when there is no record laid of it down in the district court. And I would point simply to the last paragraph in Hawkins and offer to the court the distinction between Hawkins and this case, Mendoza, because the court recognized in that last paragraph that an appeal can actually lay out a record for whether a decision to strike somebody is pretextual and or race-based. And in this case, I would suggest that the appeal has done just that. I think it would lend itself to a post-conviction argument, Justice, save and except for the fact that the record before you is complete. On the issues that are raised, the record before you is adequate. There needs to be no evidentiary hearing on whether Caucasian jurors similar to L.A., Hispanic juror L.A., which is the first Batson challenge, were allowed to serve on this jury. And under the five-prong analysis of whether non-protected persons are afforded different standards to allow them to get to a jury in a case where a protected party is the defendant and persons of his peers are not afforded the exact same criteria or criticism, I think the record is complete. And it's further completed when you go to the final and the fourth. So effectively, the state has done, by their fourth peremptory challenge, they've eliminated every Hispanic on this panel. Every one. There are only six that showed, which is, from the appellant's position, a prima facie underrepresentation. There are zero left. And the reasoning the prosecutor, Ms. Keenan, gives for why she gets rid of the last Hispanic person was just rank speculation. She says, well, she might be this way. And that's a quote. Might is the word she uses. There's never a quantifiable race-neutral reason given to the trial court, who from my perspective, the obligation is incumbent upon the trial court when a Batson objection is raised. The state volunteers a race-neutral reason to go to the third prong of Batson, as was done by the panel in the Hawkins case, and say, okay, well, what under the totality of circumstances, as the case sits 2 days into jury selection, after a motion dealing with underrepresentation has been filed and withdrawn, well, why then is this race-neutral? Why is speculation a race-neutral reason? And that's what Ms. Keenan gives. I mean, she says this juror might feel a certain way because she had a significant other who, in a different state, was questioned by law enforcement, ultimately let go. She answers the system worked, I believe, in all four punishments available in a capital trial, and she is thereafter stricken under the speculative theory of, well, she might not like us. Well, that's great, except for there is a Caucasian person allowed to serve on the panel. So she was a juror who had somebody that had been, and not one. I went through in the brief and tried to lay it out thoroughly. I mean, it's eight, I believe, that had negative law enforcement contact here in Clark County, not in California, is Hispanic jurors. And Justice Sherry, from my perspective, that is grounds enough to reverse this penalty hearing, because that's what you had. And I'll segue into the next section, but that's grounds enough to say that under the Eighth and the Sixth Amendment, that this defendant did not get an individualized sentence based on effective assistance of counsel. And I understand I raised in my second issue one that this court hesitates to deal with on direct appeal. And in light of the Batson issues and the Mazan case that says from this court in 1984 that if there is no conceivable tactical reason for lawyers to do what they did, then direct appeal can be appropriate to consider the ineffective assistance of counsel. And so I'd like to back up and recall now that we've already understand that these trial attorneys, both doing probably their first or maybe their second capital case, filed and then recanted a motion dealing with underrepresentation when they represented a protected person or a person in a protected class. They then march into a jury selection wherein they spend 2 days badgering might be overstating, but in the face of a jury, of a panel, talking about burdens of proof, presumptions of innocence, Fifth Amendment rights not to testify, and candidly put their own credibility at issue. And they do it over and over and over for two solid days, only to then, for zero tactical reason, there is no tactical reason, and I'll get into why this is appropriate for direct appeal in just 1 minute. By what can only be determined as divine intervention, do these lawyers have a tactical reason for, after selecting a jury and paneling a jury who's been told, we're going to deal with guilt, you're going to hear guilt. So the prosecution does an outstanding job of laying out evidence in their voir dire, to have only the defense lawyers, when a panel is in place, sworn, ready to hear how this defendant is factually innocent, pled straight up. I mean, and when I mean straight up, he's pled to murder in the first degree, with use of a deadly weapon, with a victim over the age of 65, and sexual assault, use of a deadly weapon, victim over the age of 65. And he's done so with the reasons that are laid out at page 35 of the opening brief. And I'll summarize. It is the reasoning given is that the defense lawyers have made a determination from the questionnaires and voir dire, because that's all that's gone on at this point in the trial, that the jury would like to see Mr. Mendoza accept responsibility. Now, that could be a strategic decision. If, in the record that existed at that moment in time, there was a word that said that, a word anywhere, in any of the questionnaires of the 100 jurors, in an answer to any of the question of the 100 jurors, and a question or answer to any of the 34 that were passed for cause or the 12 that were seated with the two alternates. Except the record exists, and there isn't. It is absent. So in order for one to believe that this was a strategic decision, one would have to go back in time from the day they pled Mr. Mendoza straight up and find something in the record that said to these trial lawyers, hey, well, juror number 43 really thinks he or she could be more lenient if somebody took responsibility. It's just the opposite.
Further fleshed out in post-conviction
attempts. I'm sorry, Mr. Justice. It would be, Justice Perigary, if there was any question about what their strategy was. And this is the unique case where there is none, because they tell Judge Bellani, when asked, our strategy was, we know the jury wanted acceptance of responsibility. Well, to know that, you either have to read minds, number one, which none of us believe these lawyers could do, or it's got to be in the record. And we went through great length, and I needed to up front, and I apologize for not, give great credit to Ms. Hyatt, Jill Hyatt, who was a law clerk with me, who worked tirelessly on this appeal, and I just want to give her some credit for that. This appeal is devoid, at the moment they plead him, of any evidence to support that strategic decision. And a strategic decision only obliterates the first prong of Strickland if it's reasonable. I mean, this one is fantasy. I mean, it's almost as if the facts are being learned as the jury is being selected. The facts are so overwhelming that some half-witted strategy is made. And I tell you, the half-witted part can be seen in the colloquy between the defendant and his lawyers and the court, because he tries to plead under the felony murder rule. There's two theories of criminal liability in count one, the murder counts. One is premeditation and malice aforethought. The second alternative theory is the felony murder rule, murder committed during perpetration of a sexual assault. You'll notice that the lawyers attempt to plead him under the felony murder rule, at least arguably under the McConnell decision, trying to get the state to lose one of its aggravating factors so that you can't have the same aggravator that gets you to first-degree murder that then gets you to the death penalty. To only have the rug pulled out from under this short term strategy and told by, you know, very capable prosecutor, we don't accept that. We're ready to start trial right now. We've got a jury who's heard this is a factual innocence case. Let's go. To which there's a short discussion, and it's impossible from the record to say if it's more than a couple of minutes, but it appears to be a couple of seconds. And the defendant says, oh, yeah, well, I'll plead guilty by premeditation and malice aforethought, too. So, and interestingly enough, probably as good a statement about this case as exists comes from the state's brief, which says the defendant, after the impanelment of a guilt jury, this is page 2 of their brief, pleads to all counts without the benefit of plea negotiations. And it may be offered to the court that, well, that's happened before. Well, who they're referring to is me. In the Bo Maestas case, I pled Mr. Maestas prior to the selection of a jury. Not straight up. I pled him to counts to cause the state to lose aggravators. I never walked in and told a jury this kid's factually innocent, and I hung that jury in what might be as bad a case as it existed at this time, at the time I did it. In this case, it appears that the effort wants to be made after the bell has been rung. And when the strategy is on the record, to address your concern, Justice Perigari, the strategy is placed on the record by the lawyers, and it's unsupported by the record, it's just like the Mazan case where the trial lawyer is berating the jury so bad that the Supreme Court on direct appeal says, you know, we got to take this up, and this is so bad it needs to go back because the result is so inherently unreliable. And I would suggest to the court that that is the facts in this case.
Well, Mr. Christiansen, assuming that the court chose not to reach the ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to jury selection, could you argue how this court is supposed to evaluate jurors 77 and 84? One of the points that the Hawkins decision addressed is the inability to understand from an appellate level the explanation by the state. And so now we have a case where the objection's made, but after the explanation offered, counsel again remains silent. So from the record before us now, how is the court to evaluate those two jurors to which an objection was made?
The candid answer, Justice Hardesty, is the court could say that the complete failure of those lawyers when the pretextual race-neutral reason is allegedly given to visit that third prong, as you're pointing me towards, and the failure of the court, who has an independent obligation to take the totality of circumstances at the time those two Hispanic women are being kicked off. That in and of itself is grounds for reversal and grounds to question the validity of this verdict. However, I believe that there is a five-prong analysis that allows the court, based on my brief, and I'm mindful of the Hawkins decision, which says it's very difficult for the Supreme Court on appellate review to understand why things happened the way they were and whether it was pretextual or race-based or not. Which is why we at great lengths went through all the other jurors, and I think I counted 8 non-protected jurors, persons of Caucasian background, who were questioned, and you look at the five prongs. One is, were the protected jurors who were kicked questioned differently than the white jurors who remained? And as I tried to discuss a little bit earlier, I think the record is, you know, abundantly clear that that occurred. Were Caucasian jurors, another prong is, were Caucasian jurors that had answers similar to the protected class jurors kept while the protected class were stricken? The answer to that is yes. So I think there are those five prongs from the appeal, and again, I point only to the last paragraph of the Hawkins decision, which the panel suggested that on appeal, if litigated adequately, this court could look at that issue. And from my perspective, having done more than a couple of these capital cases at trial, I'll be honest, I haven't been here since about 95. So the capital cases this capital case from the record, an analysis can be done adequately by this court to determine that the Batson race-neutral reasons given by the state, specifically by Ms. Keenan, when she strikes the last of four Hispanic people, based on rank speculation, she says the juror might, and this is juror AG number 84 that you pointed to.
But to do so requires the court to engage in a comparative analysis of responses by jurors from the record itself. Several courts have rejected that notion, even the Ninth Circuit, because of concerns about the demeanor of the juror who's responding. How would you suggest this court deal with that criticism of the comparative juror analysis?
I would suggest that I would concede up front that it is not the easiest of analysis to conduct. I'm mindful, I think it's the Faulkner decision that the Ninth Circuit reverses and the Supreme Court ultimately reverses the Ninth Circuit and says the trial court's decision on the ultimate question of discriminatory intent is one that's hard to review. How you it is reviewed is under the five prongs of whether something is pretextual or not. If, in fact, you don't agree with my initial position that the failure to understand as a defense lawyer in a capital case, as you should, is required by the ABA and is required by the mandates you all set in place when you passed the 250 requirements for capital lawyers, that you understand Batson if you're going to do capital work, that you understand the interaction between the guilt and the penalty phase, again, to taking everything in total, that's clear was not understood, that there can be no conceivable reason to file a motion saying, hey, as a lawyer, I recognize I represent a protected person, and that his peers, persons of his background, are prima facie underrepresented in Clark County on jurors, only to withdraw the motion, have the state strike every single one that makes it to the panel, and not ask for the analysis from that you request, Your Honor. So similarly, there is no tactical reason, none.
I guess the concern I have is this, and maybe you could address it. Assuming that the court accepted your position and said, well, on the surface of the record alone, the Batson, the counsel were ineffective in addressing the Batson issues, what's to prevent counsel in any case from just sitting back and doing absolutely nothing and then having appellate counsel assert, look, this is so clear from the record, they just disregarded their duties. You've got to reverse this. This is a structural problem. In the absence of some articulation of the failure of step three, I think we run down a slippery slope in examining direct appeal, these issues on direct appeal.
Justice, I may agree with you in theory that lawyers could start doing those things and it would be a structural issue. But I'm here on behalf of Frederick Mendoza,
sure,
who in practice, in reality, had lawyers that recognized it for zero reason that's in your record.
But we haven't heard from the lawyers. Perhaps the lawyers would say, well, Mr. Mendoza told us to strike those two people because they looked at me funny. I mean, we don't know that. I'm speculating, and I acknowledge that. But that's why post-conviction might be a better place to look at it. I was asking you, though, assuming we set aside the post-conviction, I understand that argument. I just wanted you to guide us through the analysis of those two jurors as to why we would reverse this case as to those two jurors.
Justice Hardesty, I think the analysis is that once the defense raised the Batson issue and the prosecutor offers race-neutral reasons and the trial court fails to conduct that third prong, you have to go to what's in the jury selection process, and it is without a doubt that Caucasian jurors with identical or worse problems than the two jurors that are Hispanic and are a protected class and were the last two Hispanics to make their way onto a capital jury where a Hispanic was a defendant, were stricken for non-race-neutral reasons.
Well, for example, I was kind of anticipating you'd point out the degree of law enforcement contact that other jurors had that seemed to be perhaps even worse than the two that were stricken.
And I pointed that out in theory, and it's in the brief, Justice, and so I would hope the court would spend some time reviewing that analysis that was done in writing. And if it pleases the court, I'll save my remaining four and change minutes.
I have one question. Other than the Mazin case, which is probably almost 30 years old, what authority can you direct us to that would support us addressing really what are ineffective assistance of counsel arguments on direct appeal in this case?
I'd point the court under the Batson analysis to the U.S. versus Roberts case. It's a Seventh Circuit case. It's in the brief, and I apologize, I don't have the cite with me right here. But it is where the Seventh Circuit says that the silly reason offered by the prosecution for kicking an African-American teacher because they didn't like teachers but they kept white teachers was reasons to reverse, not on ineffective, but to reverse for Batson issues. And I'd point the court there.
But other than Mazin, for the general proposition that we would do it on direct appeal rather than habeas, Mazin's your main case?
It is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christiansen. Mr. Dreskes.
Good morning. May it please the court. Robert Daskus on behalf of the respondent, the state of Nevada. Now, I was one of the two trial lawyers who actually prosecuted Frederick Mendoza. And if I could, I'd like to start with the area where Mr. Christiansen left off, and that is with the issue of the Batson challenges and prospective jurors number 77 and 84. I hear Mr. Christiansen say today, and I read in his brief, this notion that somehow we kicked Hispanic jurors who were similarly situated to Caucasian jurors. That simply is not true. I would remind the members of this court that Frederick Mendoza was charged with two crimes, murder and rape. And I would ask you respectively and rhetorically to ask yourselves, if you were the trial lawyers on this case prosecuting Frederick Mendoza, and you had prospective jurors who had either been charged with a crime or somebody they loved had been charged with a crime, what would the two crimes be that would concern you the most? Murder and rape. Jurors number 77 and 84 on voir dire stated that they had loved ones who had been wrongly accused of the very two crimes for which Frederick Mendoza was on trial. So this notion, this argument that we use that as a pretext to kick Hispanic jurors is nonsense.
Why didn't you press the court for a finding on no pretext?
Well, we, in fact...
I mean, should that be what we require? Is the state press the court for that finding if it's all falling silent after someone says race neutral? Everybody sits there and says nothing further.
Well, Justice Pickering, I think in this case, we do have a record that satisfies this notion, this argument that there were pretextual reasons, because we stood up and offered and explained the race-neutral reasons, and those are present in the record, including the two prospective jurors to which the defense attorneys made no Batson challenge. That exists in the record as well, and if I might, prospective jurors number 16 and 44, there's a footnote in our answering brief that mentions, for example, prospective juror number 16, contacts with multiple legal professionals, as well as a witness in the case. And so those were race-neutral reasons. In the questionnaire that prospective juror number 16 completed, juror number 16 said that she was not in favor of the death penalty and could never support the death penalty. So the responses to the accusations of the pretextual reasons are present in the record in this case, including the two prospective jurors to which the defense attorneys made no objection whatsoever.
Could I ask you, Mr. Daskus, about the comment you made a moment ago concerning the nature of the crime, and I understand your point on that, but could you comment about juror six, whose cousin was charged with child pornography, and juror 19, whose friend was charged with rape. I recognize not a family member, but obviously brought it up. Could you comment on those two jurors who seem to fall within the category of the substance of the crime?
Sure. They do fall within the category generally of either being contacted by law enforcement or knowing someone who was. But when you compare those two to the jurors who were kicked or who were challenged by us, the degree of contact is entirely different. Both numbers 77 and 84, their spouses, if I'm not mistaken, had the contact with law enforcement. And the thing that caused us concern, Justice Hardesty, was that the prospective jurors stated either explicitly or at least impliedly that they were wrongly accused. And I think you need look no further than the fact that the prospective jurors, in one case it was her boyfriend at the time, husband at the time of jury selection, they were still together. And so I think common sense would dictate that if there was some belief by the prospective juror that there was some truth to the accusation, probably they wouldn't still be together when the charge is murder and or rape. And so I think the degree of contact is different, and that's why they're not situated the same.
Well, I was just trying to test that, because as to juror six, the cousin was charged with child pornography, and at least I understood the record to say was acquitted, the cousin was. And then juror 19, the friend, was charged with rape and acquitted. So it would seem, at least on the surface, that those jurors, although not spouses or girlfriends, are similarly situated in terms of nature of crime and outcome that might cause a reasonable person to suggest that their friend or cousin had been inappropriately charged.
Understood, and I guess my response would be, as the trial lawyer sitting through jury selection, and I'm sure all of you can appreciate, you get a certain sense in having conversations with prospective jurors about how they really and truly feel. And I think it goes back to the point you raised with Mr. Christiansen, which is, isn't this better left for a post-conviction hearing where these things can be fleshed out and reasons can be explained? But certainly a friend or a cousin who has some contact with law enforcement is a lot different from my perspective as the trial lawyer getting a feel for the prospective jurors than someone whose spouse, according to that juror, was wrongly accused of rape or murder, the two very crimes for which Mr. Mendoza was on trial. I've heard Mr. Christiansen say today, and of course in his brief, that you can decide based on the record that these defense lawyers were ineffective for the decisions they made. And one of the things Mr. Christiansen suggests is that they should be criticized, the defense lawyers, because Mr. Mendoza pled without any benefit of a negotiation. Well, excuse me, I would suggest to you that that's precisely the point. If Mr. Mendoza had received the benefit of some negotiation, then the argument by the defense attorneys would have been lost. That's the point they wanted to make to the jury, was that Frederick Mendoza, without the benefit of a negotiation, walked in and accepted responsibility. Had he been given something in return, they couldn't make the argument. And I would quarrel with this notion that just because the decision or the strategy decision didn't work doesn't make it somehow unsound. And I would suggest to you that the decision to plead him, their strategy reasons did work. Because they wanted to make the argument that a mitigator existed, that he accepted responsibility. And if you look at the mitigators that the jurors found in this case, twice they had written or had checked the box that said the defendant accepted responsibility. Now, the weight to which that mitigator was given is an entirely different analysis. But the point is, their strategy reason, the defense attorneys, for pleading him guilty was so they could argue the existence of that mitigator, and it worked. It worked. Again, the weight to which you assign that mitigator, the jury, is an entirely different question. And I would remind this court of the facts of this case. The victim was 69 years old. She lived in a retirement community by herself. She was violently raped. She had bruises on her biceps and shoulders because she was held down by Frederick Mendoza. 6'4", 275 pounds. The victim had bruises on the inside of her thighs because Frederick Mendoza forced her legs open. After he raped her, he stabbed her 18 times in her chest. We know that because her nightgown was lifted up, exposing her breasts, and there were no defects in the clothing. In other words, he stabbed her after he raped her. And then he rolled her over onto her stomach, lifted her up by her hair to expose her throat, and ran the blade of the knife across her throat. So the evidence was offensive and it was overwhelming. And I would suggest to you, as a number of the justices pointed out in your questions to Mr. Christiansen, that the decision to plead him is better left for post-conviction. Because I would suggest that as a defense attorney in a capital case, the one thing you have to do going into penalty is to maintain credibility. And based on the facts of this case and the DNA evidence and the fingerprints, the defense attorneys would have lost all credibility had they gone through a guilt phase of the case, suggested somehow that Frederick Mendoza was innocent, and then had to deal with the penalty hearing.
But isn't his point that it was the timing of the plea after the mise-en-scene was set up and each of you had addressed the jury in fair length?
I think that is Mr. Christiansen's point, Justice Pickering, but I see it slightly different. I think that was a strategic decision by the defense lawyers. Sometimes you want to wait to see what you have before you make the decision they made in this case. And the only people who can answer that are the two lawyers who tried the case, which is why this is better left for in my opinion, post-conviction.
Well, they could have waited for a couple of witnesses to be called, Mr. Daskus. I mean, come on. I respect you very much as a prosecutor, but when you start talking about what defense attorneys should have done, you know, I don't know if that's your bailiwick. You know, I don't know if that's your area.
And I think that's the point. I think that's why this is better left for post-conviction, so that Mr. Ornos and Mr. Graskovich can testify in their oath about the reasons they did what they did. I agree with you. But the other subtle thing I would point out to the court is this. What no one has discussed is Frederick Mendoza's involvement in and participation in this decision. And if you look in the briefs in this case, this was Mr. Mendoza's first rodeo. In 1977, he raped a woman, and the case preceded the trial in 1978. And if you look at the briefs filed in this case, what you learn is that Mr. Mendoza went through jury selection in that case.
But do you see why it's so important that Batson structure lawyer? Because what you did a very smart thing. Maybe you thought we were going with Mr. Christiansen. What did you argue? The facts. To show this is a horrendous, horrendous criminal case. So you did the right thing because you're a skilled prosecutor. But that's why Batson is structural. And that's the thing we worry about. And until district judges, five and six of us were district judges, start saying, hey, wait a minute, we're gonna grant the Batson challenge. Then the burden's going to be on prosecutors like yourself, excellent prosecutors, especially in Clark County and Washoe, to make sure that third prong is reached in Batson. But that's what the problem is here. You know, until the judges in the district court starts granting Batson challenges and saying, wait a minute, you're knocking off all the African Americans, you're knocking off all the Hispanics in these type cases of protected class. It's going to be the same. It's going to be affirmance of these cases. Then it's going to go to post-conviction relief, and then we'll have to see where that goes as to what a trial attorney is going to say as to pleading somebody guilty during jury selection, you know, right after jury selection, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me as a former defense attorney.
And I appreciate that. What I would suggest to you, Justice Cherry, is that I'm not hiding from the reasons we struck the Hispanic jurors. In fact, I would invite you and encourage you to look at the transcripts in this case. Because again, if a prospective juror saying that her spouse was wrongly accused of murder or rape is not a sufficient race-neutral reason for a prosecutor in a murder-rape case to strike those jurors, then with all due respect, I don't know what is. And respectfully, Justice Cherry, when I talked about the facts of the case, it's not to avoid discussing the Batson challenge. I invite you to look at the record in this case. It's to address the notion that somehow the defense lawyers at the trial level made a mistake in pleading him guilty. And so that's why I mentioned the facts of the case and the overwhelming evidence in this case. Their hands were tied. And in order to maintain credibility and at least have mitigators to argue, they did what they did.
Do you try to challenge any of these jurors for cause? The Hispanic jurors, you know, saying, getting to say, well, maybe I can't be fair because my relative was charged with murder.
My recollection is no, because they at least said the right things. They said, I'm sure, you know, despite the fact that my spouse, then boyfriend, was wrongly accused of murder, I think I can be fair. And I go back to the comment I made to Justice Hardesty. As a trial lawyer, as the prosecutor, we have to read something into and read between the lines of those comments.
Well, I think the more that we have these cases before us on direct appeal, that it's going to be more for the defense attorneys to do a little more and satisfy the justices, like in Hawkins' situation, that the burden is really on them to do more. And I think that's what I hear, at least in our conferences, why didn't they do more?
And which goes back to, I think, everyone's point who has asked questions so far, which is, isn't this better left for post-conviction hearings and relief, where people can testify as to the strategic decisions they made and why they made them. The other thing I would point out is, I suppose at some point...
So you would concede then that this case would merit an evidentiary hearing on post-conviction?
I think it would. I think it would, particularly because you had the defense attorneys who made the decision after speaking with their client to do what they did. And I think without question, those reasons should be fleshed out. It just can't be done, with all due respect, at this level. But obviously there's a mechanism in place, and that mechanism should be utilized to have the attorneys come in and explain why they did what they did.
Mr. Daskus, could you finish your point about the 78 trial? I don't think you finished your point, and I wanted to hear it.
I appreciate it, and I was actually just about to go back there in response to Justice Pickering's question. But what happened in that case is that a jury was impaneled, and then Frederick Mendoza pled guilty. So you're talking about a defendant who had experience doing exactly what was done in this case. And again, I guess I would go back to, perhaps there was a conversation between the defense attorneys and their client, and perhaps that issue came up, the experience of the defendant, and they all decided to do what was done. But I think that cannot be glossed over and shouldn't be lost on anyone, that you've got a defendant who had been through the system before, who had been through jury selection before, and decided to do the exact same thing some 30 years later.
Mr. Daskus, I don't want to cut you off from other areas you want to address, but I have another area I'd like you to comment about, even though I don't think Mr. Christiansen had a chance to get to it yet. And that has to do with a couple of the assignments of error on prosecutorial misconduct. And specifically, there is a description of the, I have a description in the transcript of the argument concerning mercy. Could you comment on the assignment of error of prosecutorial misconduct on that subject, please?
Yes. I know there are past opinions of the Nevada Supreme Court that address the issue of mercy. And in particular, there are some cases that address the argument of a prosecutor telling a jury, show the defendant the same mercy he showed his victim. I would submit to you that that wasn't done in this case. I think the issue of mercy was addressed, and an argument was made about how that should be dealt with and coped with by the jury, but I certainly don't think that the argument crossed any line and made the precise point to the jury that the jury should show the defendant the same mercy or lack of mercy that was shown to the victim. Hopefully that answered your question, Justice Armstrong.
My understanding of their transcript is, finally, Frederick Mendoza did not show any mercy to Rita. She didn't have the dignity of 12 people handpicked for their fairness to decide her fate. The defendant gave her her death sentence and carried it out. And I just wondered what your thought was about how that fit within Thomas versus State.
Yeah, I think the distinction is it didn't go a step further, and the prosecutor didn't suggest to the jury that they cannot show the defendant any mercy because he didn't show Rita Krimberg any mercy. So I think that's the distinction. My review of the cases suggests there's nothing wrong and that argument that was made in this case is certainly permissible, that the defendant didn't show the victim any mercy and that he carried out, in essence, a death sentence all on his own. So I would suggest that based on my review of the cases, that is a perfectly permissible argument. Unless any of the justices have any further questions, I realize that I have quite a bit of time remaining. I'm happy to answer any remaining questions, but I think I addressed at least the comments Mr. Christiansen raised and hopefully answered the justices' questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Christiansen.
Thank you.
Mr. Christiansen.
Thank you. Somewhat disturbing that the state can attempt to lead, and I have the utmost respect for Mr. Daskus, lead the court to believe that this is something Frederick Mendoza had done before. First, this is a gentleman who, by Army standards, was 100% disabled from post-traumatic stress disorder. So the fantasy notion that he's directing anybody to do anything is just that. Second, the 1977 charge was sexual assault. Okay, sexual assault was the charge to which he went to trial on. After a jury was selected, with the benefit of plea negotiations, he pled to battery, a lesser offense, with the intent to commit rape. Okay. So in 78, he had lawyers that got him a benefit. In 2008, he had lawyers that didn't understand the process. And when the state says to you that the argument for acceptance was lost, acceptance of responsibility was lost had they, as Justice Cherry suggested, had a few witnesses. I tell you, it's just the opposite. The argument for acceptance was lost when they walked in and for two solid days told a panel of 100 people he was factually innocent. And it was lost to such a degree that in the rebuttal argument, about as clever a prosecutor as you will find stood up and said, how much credit should we give Mr. Mendoza for this, and this is my paraphrase, he didn't say it, the cute lawyer trick of pleading guilty after he saw the overwhelming evidence. And the overwhelming evidence existed November 17th, 2008. It existed November 16th, 2008, before they selected a jury. To not understand that it existed and to wait to blow every ounce of your credibility on a jury who would thereafter consider death reflects an unreasonable and unsupported by the record strategic decision that violates Strickland and entitles my client to a new trial. Justice Pickering, you asked me a question of relative to ineffective in Batson. I would point out the 2008 DiOmampo decision to the court and say that Batson alone, in the DiOmampo decision, a prosecutor said, we kicked this guy off because he was divorced and we didn't think he might not be able to work with women. The Supreme Court said that's just straight pretextual. All he said was he was divorced. It is identical, Justice Hartsey, to L.A. and A.G. 17 and 84, the jurors who said not that they had a concern about their other loved ones or significant others when questioned. They said he was accused. The woman actually says, the first one said, I wanted to know if he did it. And then ultimately says, I think the system worked. When Ms. Keenan says, I kick off Juror 84, AG, because she might not be able to be fair. While keeping, I counted again, 9, and they're at page 20 through 22 of my opening brief, 9 other white people with worse interactions with Vegas law enforcement, not California like these two women, smacks of pretextual. It is the might of DiOmampo that caused that to be reversed, that should cause this to be reversed on bats. And that's the black letter law that is clear. The ineffectiveness is, as you, this honorable court knows, the totality of circumstances. And under the totality of circumstances, when the state's allowed in violation of the Kaczmarek decision of 2004 to argue victim impact of the victim from 1977 and compare her post-traumatic to the defendant, When Ms. Keenan is allowed to talk about mercy for Rita and evil in violation of the Jones decision, which says you cannot ever call a defendant evil in a capital case, under the totality of circumstances, this case needs to go back to ensure him a fair and Eighth Amendment guaranteed trial with a sentence particular to him.
What do you want to say about mercy before you sit down? What about the mercy
argument? I disagree wholeheartedly that a prosecutor in a capital case has a right to shift the focus of that case from the individualized defendant who is there facing the death penalty that they choose to force upon him to the victim.
What if the defense counsel argues about mercy?
He's entitled to, Justice Cherry.
What about rebuttal by the state? I mean, that's why they get to go last.
The rebuttal by the state still has to be what the sentencing is about, and that's about what's appropriate for the defendant, not what's appropriate for a victim. It's what's appropriate under the Sixth and Eighth Amendment for the individualized consideration for Frederick Mendoza. And when she calls him evil and says he didn't give mercy to Rita, the victim, she makes it about the victim, not the defendant. It's burden shifting and it's prosecutorial misconduct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christiansen, Mr. Daskus, for your arguments here this morning. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 11:30.